Blog Talk Radio.
You know, you found Masonic Effects, just an opportunity to lean in with a few of us from around the world and relax, listen to some really quite decent jazz, and talk a bit, think about topics that have some bearing on Freemasonry, more that Freemasonry, the idea, the concept of Freemasonry has inspired these things. Oh, I'm urging one and all, as we come up to the solstice and the holiday season for my faith base, to realize the value right in front of us, overlook the challenges and tribulations of Masonry. That's all part of the universe. That's all part of the order as it is meant to be. If we were to actually experience the ideal of Freemasonry, well, the likes of you and me probably wouldn't be included in that picture, because simply, apart from ego, we're imperfect. We're the work in progress. nothing harsh or judicial about it. Just an observation. You know, the ideal we said we can experience in terms of the feeling. Think about the feeling that you associate with Freemasonry, not to the bitterness and the whining and all that stuff that's come after. No. But what's inspired you, and not what you hear about other grand lodges and their works around the globe, but what inspired you in that moment, that private moment that nobody knows about. When you were, whether that was on bended knee or whether that was when you came through the door, the excitement, the elevation. Just remember that. I think that's really quite important. Focus. It gives you focus. It is one of the first things that Freemasonry inspires in us. Not the, but one of the first things that Masonry can inspire in a man. Odd that we live in this seam. We practice something that's very, very difficult. We have those challenges of conscience. We, in our own way, aren't following necessarily the logic of education, but the experience of learning. I think there's a careful and gentle distinction to be made between those two ways of thinking. I keep, I don't want to apologize anymore about this, so I'll put it out there. There are men who are contemplative, and they seem to be joyous. There are men who like the conviviality and the club atmosphere, and they are joyous. I would never take that happiness from people. Sometimes it troubles me that the things that I know from life experience is that joy can be taken away very, very quickly, unexpectedly. How do we prepare for that? Well, that's I don't know whether that's the Hellenistic objectives of helping us to identify our frame of reference, so at a skeptic, stoic, cynic, Epicurean, you know, are you, maybe that's the point, to help prepare and to recognize that when we're reacting to what's going on around us in the world, that we have a mindset that is not the or definitive mindset, but it's one that's familiar to us. Saying that, I'm also aware that so many men hold themselves back from the beauty of accepting their talents, their abilities, their truth, the way that they are capable of understanding what's going on around, and that in many, many cases, they've not admitted to any other living soul. Men tend to be that harsh critic. Huh? Not to fault the innocence. If I was to hold the world in the palm of my hand and look at what's happening, I would think that materialism has gained a strong foothold, wouldn't you? I'm not here to talk about the intentions of the oligarch and how their goals and their best interests are certainly not mine. I'm here to talk about understanding. Understanding how that pendulum is moving right now. The cycles are revealing themselves to us today. Dare I begin to think, somewhere in the recesses of the mind, men were putting their heads, people, human beings, great genius, not gender, I mean, I have to get over that kind of tragic habit. The minds were putting them, working with the idea of this impending end, the potential, the mathematics that what exists can end. Mm-hmm. Now we talk about apocalyptic events, a climate event, but in very veiled terms. I would be really quite annoyed if somebody was outside my door beating a drum, screaming about the apocalypse to come. I've had that for many, many years. I've had the apostolates trying to wring that and that humility out of me. Different faith groups do it all the time. That was my boyhood, and I dare say the boyhood of a lot of listeners, the childhood of a lot of listeners. There was something wrong with us. We were in some way sinful. And then we begin to understand where all of this was generated, how it was articulated. Apocalypse to come, well, we have the science that it calculates it. But we also have the mathematics that calculates the extinction of our sun. It's hard to really put your mind to that type of enormity. Hundreds of billions of years in the future, nuclear furnace that is just up there sending out light and radiation and all kinds of other interesting molecules to us, electrons and to us, neutrons, is going to eventually dissipate. Well, I don't necessarily think that that's what I need weighing heavily on me. It is what it is. What's, I think, more important for me, and perhaps some of you, is realizing that this is we're here for a very short period of time. And at some point, thankfully, gratefully, it's pointed out, or we discover, that we have choices to make. We can go through life resolute, firm. We can go through life angry. We can go through life affected by events far beyond our control and have an emotional reaction to them that is real and legitimate in every sense of the word. And then for the fortunate few or the fortunate many, we have an ability to realize our resolution, a resilience. How we get there, how you get there, depends on your ability, not on whether it's justified to the world around. You need not feel it's important to justify yourself to anybody. No. We find that as we're looking through the works of Freemasonry. And can I talk privately between us, brethren? I've often thought, not that our ritual has more to do with innocence in the first, naivete in the second, and the inevitable mortality, death, the darkness in the third. But birth, adulthood, and death, that seems to be enough for a lot of people. It's just something to think about. Today, we have a good commentary, I think, debate on the aesthetic of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. The poetry today is from a fellow who was outrageous and had this sense, I think, of the shortness of life. He died in his 30s. I think he was, 30, 32 years old when he died. This is, and he happened to be a Mason and a poet, Lord George Byron, the sixth Lord Byron. Anyway, his poem that I'm bringing forward today is called Darkness. I know. I think you'll like it. And then we tip our hand to the work, to understanding this whole business of enlightenment and how that helped to, reshuffle the deck. And then we've gone on from that, getting our head around the advances we've made since that is not easy lifting for some people. For some, it's very, very difficult. For many, to understand the enormity of that part of history and the historiography. But what I'm trying to say is welcome. Welcome. I'm very glad to welcome you to the program today, morning, afternoon, night, wherever you are on the face of the earth. I think you'll like the program, and I hope it's entertaining and informative. We'll see. What have we got to lose? This is a little bit of, we'll kick it off with a little bit of work by Ike Quebec. I've Got a Crush on You from 1962. Beautiful sound. If, as Plato and Aristotle suggest, beauty is a form of truth so satisfying as to be a source of undeniable pleasure, we would be led to believe that the beauty of speculative Freemasonry is an intrinsic for us to consider and receive the benefits as such. I confess often I have felt, when that is not valued, the functional face of our brotherhood has taken on aspects of social service clubs. Not that I find that offensive. Members openly declaring their efforts receive status of a sort. Whether this is self-serving or altruism, I'll leave that to the reader. My flawed reality assumed a beauty within the nature of Freemasonry was there for those curious enough to learn. It It took some time for me to realize I was playing with the alternative idea of subjective existence. The beauty of the craft exists in the mind rather than objective subjective beauty. We know previously art was carefully controlled by religion because there could not be two sources of truth. We know this changed during the Renaissance in various European nations as a scientific method helped humanity fulfill a democratic condition. The arts were examined and re-examined for truth in beauty. In the 21st century, philosophical debate has largely been replaced by materialism. Whether beauty is objective or subjective flows toward interest groups that have absorbed social stratification. You know, oligarchs, that type of thing. Do we consider our symbols and furniture similarly? Do they have meaning whether we value them or not? Immanuel Kant was onto something, raising questions that didn't confuse but helped us clarify. So if I explain today Freemasonry is objectively beautiful, how would I offer proof? And if I did, would my opinion shape your thinking any more than the beauty of our philosophy? Probably not. It is simply a testament to a fact about Masonry. Our order puts before us serious questions. The means to examine our nature if we attempt answers. always interesting when I happen to find somebody that happened to be a Freemason who has genuine talent. I don't subscribe to the idea that the appeal to celebrity in any way legitimizes Freemasonry or anything else for that matter. What does an actor or an actress or a songwriter have that would qualify them to comment on the state of a nation, on the environment, on it's self-interest, eh? The same as you and me. We have if we dive into something, we can be as legitimate a source of information. No, they have no more credibility than a newspaper column, truthfully. So why do we bother with that? I don't subscribe to the notion that the celebrity means anything. It is what it is. So here, if you don't mind, we'll talk about this fellow in the context of the genuine contribution he made to poetry, to culture. Now, I'm going to talk about romanticism, but not in the schoolboy, giggly, behind-the-hand type of notion. This is a poetic movement of the late 18th and early 19th century. You think about it, that's about the time when Masonry was starting to develop and reach some level of fruition. And imagine this gave credibility to an understanding, a vehicle for understanding and expressing nature in the interior world of feeling. Well, just why would that matter? Well, think about it. Here we, like so many other things, we take it for granted. If you want to talk about your inner state, mindfulness, whatever, you're perfectly free to do that. But think about the day when that didn't occur. When the hot licks were happening by inspired artists who were going where nobody had gone before. It became a movement. And think about this. It stood in opposition to the mannered formalism and disciplined scientific inquiry of the Enlightenment era that preceded it. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Mannered formalism and disciplined scientific inquiry of the Enlightenment era. Well, of course. This school, we'll go through this because I think continue on with the works, particularly into 2021. Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, Busey, Shelley, Blake, and Byron. Produced work that expressed various spontaneous feelings and found parallels in their own emotional lives in the natural world. And they celebrate, this is a celebration of creativity rather than logic. Kind of blatant, isn't it, to what we're doing here in Masonic Effects. The whole idea of spontaneity and creativity, the jazz, you know, the... So transparent. Byron was an interesting guy, and very, very quickly, he was a child of Captain Jack Byron and Jack's second wife, Catherine Gordon. She was a Scots heiress. So after Jack went through all of her fortune, or most of it, his mother took him to Aberdeen, and they lived on very, very meager income. Jack died in France in 1791. Too bad, so sad, says, you know, Catherine. But George Gordon Byron had been born with a club foot, and he early developed an extreme sensitivity to his lameness. But in 1798, it's like the planets lined up. He was 10 years old. He unexpectedly inherited the title and estates of his great uncle, William, the fifth Baron Byron. So his mother took him to England, where the boy fell in love with the halls and the spacious ruins of Newstead Abbey, which were presented to the Byrons by Henry VIII. Yeah, that one. So after living in Newstead for a while, Byron was sent to school in London. In 1801, he went to Harrow, one of England's most prestigious schools. In 1803, he fell in love with his distant cousin, Mary Chaworth, who was older and already engaged. And when she rejected him, she became a symbol of, for Byron, of idealized and unattainable love. He probably met Augusta Byron, his half-sister, from his father's first marriage that same year. But in 1805, he entered Trinity College in Cambridge, where he piled up debts at an alarming rate and indulged in the conventional vices of undergrads. And this is where we saw signs of and it has to be mentioned, in sexual ambivalence. It carried right on. He was imprisoned for this. Anyway, you can see that this is a fellow that he took a seat. He took a seat in the House of Lords, and then he went on the grand tour through Europe. And this, and in France, he began Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, very, very famous piece of work. But that's not why we're here today. This is darkness. This is what happened after he experienced a volcanic eruption. Okay? After he experienced a volcanic eruption, he was inspired. And he began to write. Here, think about this. It was the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia. And it changed the weather conditions across the world. And in 1816, it was branded the year without a summer. The same event led to him traveling to Lake Geneva. And he was writing and involved with Mary Shelley. She produced a masterpiece. She produced Frankenstein. But Byron, writing in darkness, the extermination of the sun seemed like a dream, yet it was no dream, but a strange and almost terrifying reality. Here. What does this draw? Does this poetry draw anything to mind? It's not his belief, the writer's belief. What emotion stirs in you when you read this? When you hear this, I had a dream, which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and darkened in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day. And men forgot their passions in the dread of this their desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light. And they did live by watchfires, and the thrones, the palaces of crowned kings, the huts, the habitations of all things that which dwell were burnt for beacons. Cities were consumed, and men were gathered round their blazing homes to look once more into each other's face. Happy were those who dwelt within the eye of the volcanoes and their mountain torch. A fearful hope was all the world contained. Forests were set on fire, but hour by hour they fell and faded, and the crackling trunks extinguished with a crash, and all was black. The brows of men, by the despairing light, wore an unearthly aspect. As by fits, the flashes fell upon them. Some lay down and hid their eyes and wept, and some did rest their chins upon their clenched fists and smiled. And others hurried to and fro and fed their funeral piles with fuel and looked up with mad disquietude on the dull sky. With curses, cast them down upon the dust, and gnashed their teeth and howled. The wild birds shrieked and terrified did flutter on the ground and flapped their useless wings. The wildest brutes came tame and tremulous, and vipers crawled and twined themselves around the multitude, hissing but stingless. They were slain for food. And war, which for a moment was no more, did glut himself again. A meal was bought with blood, and each set suddenly apart, gorging himself in gloom. No love was left. All earth was but one thought, and that was death, immediate and inglorious. And the pang of famine fed upon all entrails. Men died, and their bones were tombless as their flesh. The crowd was famished by degrees, but two of an enormous city did survive, and they were enemies. They met beside the dying embers of an altar place where they had been heaped, a mass of holy things, for an unholy usage. They raked up and shivered, scrapped their cold skeleton hands. The feeble ashes and their feeble breath blew for a little life and made a flame which was a mockery. Then they lifted up their eyes as it grew lighter and beheld each other's aspect, saw and shrieked and died. Even of their own mutual hideousness they died. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe. We're talking here about history and trying to unravel the adjustments that came about during the Enlightenment and because of the Enlightenment. We're talking about the extant records that help us to understand the transition from operative to speculative masonry. And I'm doing this as if it matters, as if it matters today. This whole business that we declare ourselves, and I declare ourselves speculative without, I think, paying much attention to how that came about and then what that tells us about our order. It says, remember that when these merchants, largely it was merchants that were brought in, they were non-operative, not operative stonemasons, they were accorded liberty to the gentlemen and merchants and minor officials. They were accorded a liberty that had a medieval origin. Between the liberty of buying and selling in the burg, which given to burgesses who were also merchants, and the term freedom, generally accorded to those who were now free to work in their hand trade, amid those distinctions, now imposed within their midst, a significant number of operative masons continued in the Dundee Lodge. It struggled throughout the century, as did the other crafts, to protect and control the labor of their working members, often against the practices employed by local merchants. Interesting, huh? And to ensure that members would employ only craftsmen duly admitted to the guild. What we're talking about is merchants trying to cut their costs. Huh? Isn't that interesting? Huh? And to ensure that members would employ only craftsmen duly admitted to the guild. So what happened to the integrity of the guild? Well, obviously it suffered. Yet there is also some evidence of tension within the lodge between the working men and their betters, in quotations. By contrast, we can compare the Dundee Lodge with one that met in London in the 1730s. With over 100 members, not one was a working mason, and the vast majority were mercantile by trade. Indeed, most English lodges were purely non-Masonic. One of the perennial effects of Dundee's poverty was the absence of sufficient funds to repair public works, as well as a dearth of capital to repair ruinous properties, owing to the poverty of the owners. Clearly, it was in the interest of the lodge to find ways to foster such improvements. In addition, there was the problem of vagrancy and begging, in other words, of social control. These social and economic problems occurred, however, within a distinct political culture, as the Whig ministry in London, led by Walpole, came to control Scottish political life. Much patronage came under its purview, and under the skillful manipulation of its man in Scotland, the Earl of Hay. No office, no agency or revenue collection from salt to the excise was small enough to escape Whig attention. Concomitant with and indeed augmenting this consolidation of power was a policy of improvements, which established commissions to improve fisheries and manufacturing and to encourage agricultural experimentation and innovation. And by the 1730s, the local masons were actively involved in promoting public work projects, contributing generously in 1739 to a fund for building a workhouse for beggars and other poor. In 1730, guildsmen and burgesses were joined in petitioning the magistrates to build a new prison, with a local mason promptly volunteering to take down the old one for a modest fee. Culture was also imported into the town, and in 1734, Freemasons paraded to the local theater to see a production brought in specifically from Edinburgh. For all the local guilds, the Masons were most active in a process of improvement, which is visible in Dundee by the 1730s, despite its chronic economic problems. Even the appearance of famine in the vicinity in 1741 did not stop the town council 2 years later from putting up the money to hire a professor of mathematics and bookkeeping for the local public school. This is not to say that the Freemasons of Dundee were necessarily Whigs, but it is to say that they promoted the political culture of improvement associated with the Whig ascendancy. It is also worth noting, if only in passing, that the habit of clubbing was more pronounced among late 17th century Whigs in London than it was among their Tory rivals. Isn't that interesting? You see the transition, don't you? And was it foresight to, and you think, these are people that didn't have a lot. Circumstance, well, we could say now, circumstance contributed to compromise. Otherwise, they would have just continued as operative Masons, quite happy and been able to afford the upkeep and maintenance of their lodges. But they couldn't. And then we see that the apparent impact of the merchants, the commodification, you know, the detentions within the lodge, and certainly the operative Masons would have held some status because they had granted access to the mercantile non-operative Masons. And yet we see, we don't know we know their retention, but we don't know the details of it, whether it was the strength of personality or what. Or grasping this good idea to build a workhouse. That's enormously expensive. And we see then the drift toward change, social reform in the hands of non-governmental organizations. You could see the mandarins, the bureaucrats, I'm not talking about the kind of bureaucrats we have within the order today, but the bureaucracy, the broad brush bureaucracy, being quite concerned about the influence, and the church certainly would be concerned, especially when you would hear a Mason espousing the values of the human age of agency. And expressing the condition, the human condition, as a way of life. Only devilishly not being confrontive about it. Not giving cause to send in troops.
Unmoved and cold, I must
Can't help but notice that we're coming upon the solstice, the winter solstice. It's a time of acknowledgement. It is, for some of us, a connection with our past, with that awe and wonder that of the spectacle happening around us with no real explanation, and a dissatisfaction that the explanation of the religious orders wasn't quite making sense. But it was enough at the time until something more accurate and efficient came along. Here in my culture, I celebrate the Christmas, and I'll certainly begin to extend best wishes in that spirit to all of you, wherever you happen to be, whatever circumstance you happen to be in. Masonry is not going to give you answers, but it inspires. It inspires, and through inspiration, if you begin to feel that there's some benefit to you to embrace things that inspire you, whatever they are, then a couple of things will happen. You'll have a sense of surprise and well-being and satisfaction. But more importantly, when you reflect on the deeper questions and issues about yourself and your purpose, you'll find that you'll be able to creep up on your true nature without worrying about, you know, the barriers of pride or the delusions of our own thinking, you know, wanting to be something that we're not, It's interesting when we come to terms with who we are. Because what's interesting in terms of the brotherhood is the effect that this has on you and on the rest of us. It reflects. So go about your business this week. I know you will. You don't need my permission to do that. Conduct yourself with the harmony that you deserve. And you'll find that those opportunities, you know, circumstance of impatience will be there around you. They always are. But do you begin to become aware of your own control? Being impatient is not new. It happens all around us. We're certainly... Here's a little secret. You're not the center of the universe. Never were, never will be. We are all the center of our own universe. Everyone. Almost, you're closing in on 8 billion. Everybody's the center of the universe. So these things happen. Is it news? Why act surprised? Is it complete news that you're going to experience impatience, or you're going to, if you have any intelligence at all, you'll be processing and you'll be seeing things that are flawed. Pointing that out, does that make you feel better somehow? Pointing it out, the shortcomings of somebody else? Well, more interesting question is, what happens if you control that? Where you begin to see just what is, it is what it is, without the value judgment, without the good or bad. Oh, I know that this will make the black and white thinkers a bit furious. I don't apologize for that. But I'm not sympathetic about your fury at me or anger at me. No. Come to grips with yourself. Look beyond the governance. Look beyond the social aspects of the order. Look within yourself and be reminded. There's a notion of conviviality. And when you are able to express your and control your emotion, it comes across. You become in that way influential. And Lord knows the rest of us could use a good influence. Take care of yourselves. And as you look up at the sky, notice that the solstice is there. And behind that, what's coming next is a return of the sun. I have to put another log on the fire. I'll look forward to being here with you next week. Thanks very much for tuning in. It means a great deal.